Welcome to the Up My Nursing Game podcast. I am your host, Annie Fulton. This podcast addresses common nursing questions and pitfalls with the help of doctors, expert nurses, and other healthcare staff. My hope is that knowledge sharing and friendly conversation will not only improve nursing practice, but also serve to help break down barriers that exist between nurses and hospital staff. The views expressed on this podcast and its media platforms are solely those of the participants and not their current or past employers. Please always follow your state's Board of Nursing standard of care and your institution's policies, protocols, and procedures. For today's episode, we'll be talking about a subject that can be hugely challenging for nurses: caring for homeless patients. Patients experiencing homelessness often come with a set of needs that are unique and difficult for nurses to relate to. To help us nurses gain a better perspective, I've asked Dr. Joe Mega to sit down with me today to talk about homelessness and how nurses can provide better care to our patients experiencing it. Dr. Joe Mega is a family medicine doctor who trained at Contra Costa Family Medicine Program in Martinez, California. After graduating from residency in 2014, he worked full-time in the emergency department at Contra Costa Regional Medical Center. In 2016, he joined the Public Health Department and became the medical director for the Contra Costa Healthcare for the Homeless Project, splitting his time between the ED and seeing patients on the streets. His areas of passion include addiction medicine, social justice in medicine, and improving equity in marginalized populations. Dr. Mega, thank you for being on the show today.
Of course, yeah, thanks for having me.
So I understand you're in a little bit of a transition here, having moved from California to Arizona. Can you just share a little bit about this new position that you've taken in Arizona?
Sure. So about 2 weeks ago, my wife and I moved to Eastern Arizona to start working on the White River Apache Reservation. Next week, we're going to find out the details of that. But from what we know, because we've been interviewing mostly over Zoom, this is actually our first time coming here. We're going to be working at a pretty rural hospital on the reservation, and my wife's an emergency room doctor, so she's going to be working primarily in the emergency department. Wow. And I'll be doing, I think, half-time emergency department and half-time primary care clinic. So it'll be a big change, but we're excited, and I think it'll be sort of fun medicine because it'll be austere and we'll be, you know, doing a lot of interesting work, I think.
Yeah. So it sounds like you might not have all the resources at hand that you would when you were, say, practicing in the Bay Area.
Yeah. It'll be interesting. Both my wife and I worked at county hospitals in the Bay. And I mean, hers was in Oakland, so that was certainly had more resources. But at my hospital, we didn't have a lot of specialty services. So there was a lot of taking care of people and then having to stabilize them and send them to different facilities. So I think there'll be some of a lot of that, but also we did have specialists in-house and this hospital won't. So it'll be interesting. We're both spending a lot of time reading and listening to podcasts before we start to make sure that we're, you know, buffed up on some of our skills that we may not have used in a while. So I think it'll be a fun adventure.
Oh, that's so awesome. So it sounds like you're really passionate about social justice. And I was wondering, you know, what came first, your interest in medicine or your interest in social justice?
I think my interest in medicine, I think, grew out of an interest in sort of biology and science when I was a kid and growing up. I think I didn't realize that the two were distinct in people's minds. And I had a real wake up call. Went to school and met other people and learned what people's impressions of country and people's access to medical care were like. I grew up to a single mother in a pretty poor household. I didn't have health care for some portions of when I was growing up, and neither did my mom. And so it felt like a real injustice that was the case. But I also thought that other people, you know, recognized that this was a problem, and it was sort of eye-opening to me to enter the world and realize that wasn't the case. And as I moved further along in my training, I started to realize that the health disparities that existed were something that I wanted to focus on addressing, because they didn't seem like it could be ignored as you were providing healthcare. But I really initially thought I wanted to work internationally, and I have spent some time in other countries, and there's so much culturally and just trying to figure out what the best way to do that is. I took some time in between my third and fourth year of medical school and did a master's in public health in Baltimore, and just kind of had a wake up call to like, wait a second, there's so much going on around me. And I think I'm maybe personally better suited to work here for now, because I have a better understanding of kind of what's going on socially in this country. And in particular, when I was doing my public health master's, I spent some time working with homeless populations in Baltimore, and that, you know, became an interest of mine at that time. And so then I kind of shifted my focus on, you know, issues in the United States.
Okay. So like many nurses, I've really struggled providing care for patients experiencing homelessness. And I guess what I found is that their priorities are just so very different than, say, my priorities as a housed person living in general stability. I'm so excited for you to be here today to enlighten me today about homelessness, because I feel that, you know, nurses and doctors, maybe even more so than nurses, approach homeless patients with a lot of, I don't know, animosity, like ready to go to battle with them, you know, consider them unreasonable, unclean, just kind of write them off as drunks or drug addicts. And my goal today is that after this interview with you, that I and listeners will have a better understanding of homelessness and be able to work with our patients experiencing homelessness and not work against them. So let's start off by laying some groundwork here. You know, I think homelessness, when we talk about homelessness, is a very broad term, and especially in the Bay Area where I live and where Dr. Mega has practiced for the last bunch of years, is a broad term because there's a housing crisis going on, and many people just simply cannot afford living in an apartment or a home, and they end up living in cars. That's a lot of what I see. What does homelessness mean, and how can we kind of define what it means?
There's a lot there.
Yeah.
It's a good starting point, though. So I think it's a good question. There are kind of two somewhat academic ways that homelessness is broken down if you're considering which resources people have might have access to. Housing and Urban Development has a definition of homelessness that includes basically anyone who's living in a place not meant to be inhabited. So that would include, you know, street, shelter, and obviously shelters are meant to be inhabited, but they're not permanent housing, or cars. So that's like a much more restrictive definition, but that is what the federal government uses in terms of prioritizing people for housing. The Health and Human Services has a much broader definition that's basically anyone who's not on a lease. So if you're doubling up in an apartment, if you're living with your parents, living with family members, et cetera, you'd qualify as being homeless technically. And, you know, I sometimes joke with people like, you know, I have friends who live with their parents or whatever, like, well, technically you're considered homeless. So it's pretty broad, but it's also a good way to make sure that we're capturing everyone who may, you know, have unstable housing. And the whole point of making sure that we're capturing, you know, people who meet these criteria is because we know that homelessness is a marker for a lot of other bad health outcomes, either more severe chronic disease, more chronic diseases, or if you're what in some circles, like there's a street medicine organization that refers to folks as rough sleepers, you know, people who literally sleep on the street, and the rate of mortality among that population is much higher than folks, for instance, who are sleeping in their car. So all those things matter when you're trying to figure out like what higher risk this person is at for having a bad outcome on the medical side, and then also what services they might qualify for.
So do you have any tips for nurses who are, you know, for example, working in triage or admitting a homeless patient, of how to go about asking these questions pertaining to homelessness?
Yeah, I think it's just like many other things that we screen for, asking like, sexual orientation, gender identity questions, or, you know, screening for suicide, making sure that we just broadly screen everyone so no one feels like they're being targeted is really important. And so many hospital systems have screening questions. It's actually something that at our hospital we ask at registration, and then often the nurses will ask it on a secondary screening. And so I think asking the question that, so it's inclusive of potentially any version of homelessness, doesn't make it feel like you're targeting people who might be sleeping on the street. So, you know, for instance, do you live in an apartment house or have your name on a lease is sort of an opt-in question, right? Like you're not saying, are you homeless? But you're offering a way for the person to describe their living situation. So I think if the hospital system doesn't have that, it's really important to get that information up front so that you can start thinking about, you know, how that might affect the person's care. Because if you're, you know, for instance, prescribing a medication at discharge from the emergency room, for example, and that person doesn't have a car and they don't live in a place where they can walk to a pharmacy, for instance, where I work, most pharmacies are not within walking distance because it's a pretty suburban area. Then I have to do some troubleshooting to make sure that person can get the medication or dispense it from the hospital before they leave. And that's just, you know, one example of how it might affect someone's care.
Yeah. Yeah. I know at my hospital, we have, I think what we call an indigence supply. So if a patient is homeless and we're about to discharge them with a prescription that we can provide, I don't know what it is. I'm going to say maybe a month's worth of supply that we hand to them before they leave the hospital.
Yeah, that's great. A lot of hospitals have some version of that. Like my wife did her residency at Highland Hospital, and they have a pharmacy on site, and they're very well versed at making sure that people have the potentially have the medication in hand if it's necessary when they leave. But I often encounter my patients, you know, when I'm caring for them on the street, who have just a pile of printed prescriptions, right? They never take it to the pharmacy. So if you have the option to electronically prescribe something for someone, at least it gets to the pharmacy. And then it's one less step to making sure that the patient can pick it up. And so, you know, there's so many different versions of that, but medications in particular can be a real challenge.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I can only imagine. We'll touch on that a little bit more when we talk about patient belongings. But I guess, you know, at the beginning of the episode, I alluded to that, you know, I want to get a better understanding of what the needs are of patients experiencing homelessness. And I realized that, you know, as a nurse, my priorities are, you know, safety and improving, you know, patient outcomes and having good vital signs. But these are not necessarily the priorities of patients experiencing homelessness. So I thought it would be helpful for us to kind of walk through and highlight some differences, or, you know what's unique for homeless patients compared to the rest of our patient populations. And first of all, you mentioned that, you know, working in the emergency department, you've often come across that patients who present to ED, they end up being admitted to the hospital, but they don't want to be admitted. And I have to admit that I was a little bit surprised to hear that, because in my mind, I think, well, why wouldn't a patient want to be admitted, right? Like, they're going to have a warm bed and they're going to have guaranteed all meals provided. They're going to be, you know, I hate to say this word, but, you know, waited on by their nurse. So why wouldn't they want to be admitted to the hospital? And so I guess I'll let you take it from here. Like, why do homeless patients not necessarily, do they not want to be admitted to the hospital?
Yeah, I think you said something really important at the onset of this discussion, where you mentioned, like, the idea of having a sense of safety and home. And I think just considering that, comparing probably all of us who are working in the hospital, and it's not necessarily true that we all have a safe place to go home to, but the majority of people probably do. And so that's, like, not something we're considering, right, when we go to work. But when folks who don't have a safe place or a sense of home or shelter come to the hospital, first of all, when I'm on the sending side, when I see a person on the street and they're really sick, there's a lot of hesitancy to come to the hospital in the first place. One, it might be that their belongings, which are all the things that they own in their life, are in a place that might be unsafe. And there's a lot of theft and abatement that happens, meaning, like, you know, the city comes and cleans up a place a person's living, or the police come and clean it up. So there's a lot of fear that people are going to lose their belongings. And then secondly, you know, there's a lot of stigma in the hospital. And that's often what I hear from patients is, you know, they're going to not treat me right because I'm homeless, or I don't have clean clothes, or I've been there before and I've had a bad experience. And then often people have pets, and, you know, for many of us, if we have a pet, we can get someone to watch it, but that might not be the case for folks who live on the street. And this creature might be their best friend, their companion, their sense of safety. Leaving that, you know, to someone that they aren't sure is going to take good care of it or don't necessarily trust can be hard. So there's a lot of reasons why people might not want to be admitted to the hospital, or even go to the hospital in the first place. And then also, I just think there's this sense of independence that, independence that people like to have and are used to. And part of that is it's like a survival mechanism. And part of that is some people, I don't want to say end up homeless, but some people end up in the position of being homeless because they have some challenges with rules or authority. And I think that that's a minority of folks, but I think it also develops over time as people have been, you know, living in harsh environments. And then they come to the hospital and they're being told what to do every second, right? Like, give me this blood sample. Give me this urine sample. You can't go to the bathroom now. I'm sorry, I'm busy. And I'll say, like, I just, you know, my wife just had a baby and we wanted to get out of the hospital as soon as possible. We weren't getting any sleep. People were coming in all the time. And so I imagine if your life is, you know, one in which you're not used to following directions, or you have some other priorities and you don't understand why these things are being done, then it can be really challenging. And I think we all encounter situations where we're so used to doing stuff, right? Like, give me this part of your body, I'm going to put a thing inside it, right? I'm going to put a catheter, or I'm going to put an IV. And, you know, for people who have had trauma or aren't used to, you know, being touched or being told what to do, it can be really challenging. And so there's so much there, but I think just considering that when you're taking care of folks who are experiencing homelessness is really important.
Yeah, no, I have to agree that, like you and your wife, I too was in the hospital when I had my son. And I remember that the residents would round on me at 5 a.m. and they would wake me up and ask me, you know, rapid fire questions about how I was doing. And I was just thinking, like, God damn it. Like, I know what's going on here. I know you're just residents, just doing your job. But I'm a brand new mom here. I'm exhausted. I'm hormonal. Please let me sleep. And I think one of the best experiences nurses can have in providing, to provide more compassionate care is to be a patient in a hospital and realize, like, all that's demanded of you and how frequent, you know, to me, sleep is important, how often I was woken up. And I think these personal freedoms, I guess where I'm going to call it that, are perhaps even more important to, you know, patients experiencing homelessness, because they often, you know, they don't live by anyone else's rules. They kind of live by their own, and to give them up is a big deal in a hospital setting.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there is another subset of people who don't want to leave the hospital that I work with in my position of healthcare for the homeless. Pre-COVID, we had a respite shelter, and, you know, there was sort of a fixed time that people could stay, but man, people would do all sorts of things to try to stay in the respite shelter, which was literally in the same adjacent building as the other shelter. It was just a little bit bigger than the other shelter. And there's certain folks who I think ultimately develop some sense of learned helplessness over time and like being taken care of. Mm-hmm. And when they come to the hospital, they don't want to leave, right? And that's its own challenge of trying to figure out how to safely discharge people, because they go from having, you know, poor access to food and not a lot of resources to having all those things provided for them. And I think that that is its own challenge for medical providers.
So, you know, going with that a little bit, I think it'd be helpful for us to kind of go over for some tips and tricks for kind of meeting our patients' needs who are experiencing homelessness. And one thing you brought up was their belongings, that if patients are living in an encampment, that the chance that their belongings will be stolen is just very high. So obviously belongings are very important to patients. And what strategy have you used for kind of, you know, addressing that need of homeless patients to have either their belongings with them or to have them secured in a safe place while they're hospitalized?
It often is the reason people don't want to go to the hospital on my end when I'm working with them, like pre-hospital. You know, one thing that I do is just try to negotiate with people to figure out, you know, if you can only take two trash bags or whatever in the ambulance, what are the most important things, and talking kind of through how I can help safeguard the stuff. And there's resources out there, at least in my county. There's a homeless outreach team called the CORE team who sometimes can help, you know, check on stuff or whatever. And I think that can be helpful on the hospital end too, if someone's very worried about their belongings and they didn't bring anything with them or they brought only a few things, maybe trying to ask them, like, is there anyone I could call? Is there a service that's available? Talk to social workers and see if there's something that exists to help patients. There's also, in terms of pets, often the local pet shelters will actually keep people's animals while they're in the hospital if that's needed. And that's been really helpful for folks who are really worried about their dogs or cats.
Oh, totally.
But then I think
as a mom and someone who I worry very much about my son and his well-being, and I think to a lot of our patients who are experiencing homelessness, their pets are like their children or their family. And knowing that their pets are safe and well taken care of, it's got to weigh very heavily on them. So I really like that tip that you brought up about perhaps getting a shelter, you know, the pound involved to take care of that pet while the patient is in the hospital.
And sometimes people bring the pet to the hospital with them, and then I talk to whoever I need to talk to see if they can keep it. And I think if it's a well-behaved animal and the person can be responsible for it while they're there, and it's not, you know, peeing on the floor in the room, then that's okay. And if it can't, then we have to figure out ways to compromise, and that can be a challenge. But I think, you know, trying to support people with the most important creatures in their life, you know, is I think can be really helpful.
So are you saying that patients at the hospital you've worked in the past have been able to have their pets with them in their hospital rooms?
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, definitely in the emergency department, people bring dogs all the time, and they're usually lap dogs that are pretty well behaved. But, you know, depending on if it's in a, I don't even know if it matters if they have paperwork, but I think if it's considered an emotional support animal or a service animal, then I think the hospital is supposed to be able to make accommodations for it. And I honestly don't know the details about how people get authorization for like true support animals, but I write letters all the time about, you know, supporting a person's need for an emotional support animal, because I have seen amazing examples of people who are super depressed or really not taking care of their health, getting a pet and really, you know, changing their behavior and personality. And so I think whatever I can do to support people to thrive is, you know, can be helpful. And same in the hospital, if there's an option for the person to be able to keep their dog and it's well-behaved, then why not try?
You know, as a bedside nurse, like, I would be more than happy to have a pet at bedside. But then again, I'm not in the management side of the hospital, and I don't necessarily worry about the legalities that they do. But I think, you know, while this podcast is geared towards bedside nurses, it's worth bringing up these kind of larger logistical issues that maybe nurses can like later advocate for within their hospitals. So I've never seen an animal at bedside, but that's something that, you know, after our discussion with you, that's something that I would like to encourage. If it's the difference between a patient leaving AMA or staying, heck, I would love to have an animal in the hospital.
Yeah, and I think that that's maybe the strategy for any issue that comes up, right? Like if you don't know if it's possible for a person to do this thing and it's going to make or break their hospital stay and, you know, really affect their health, then why not ask and see how you can make it happen? I think the same thing comes up with patients smoking cigarettes. Like I am not encouraging anyone to smoke cigarettes, but with every use disorder that I encounter, my approach is a harm reduction one. Most people aren't going to quit smoking when they're hospitalized. And if it's a matter of them leaving, you know, for 5 or 10 minutes to go smoke a cigarette and, or leaving the hospital, then like, let's figure out how to get that person the ability to smoke a cigarette. And there's been times when I was a resident that I would, there was a person who was hospitalized for months and months and months and really needed to be in the hospital. I ultimately just wheeled her out every day and let her smoke a cigarette. And I worked it out. And then over time, she deemed she could do it on her own. And a CNA was able to do it from there on. And, you know, it wasn't what everyone wanted to see, someone going out and smoking every day. But we also wanted to make sure that her health was taken care of. And so I think there's often negotiations, both on the patient side and the administration side, that you can work with to make happen.
That's a perfect example of something that, you know, at bedside nurses, maybe we're a bit limited in how much we can influence this policy. But, you know, I too would love to see some sort of protocol in place for patients to have cigarettes. And like you, I'm not advocating smoking at all. But then again, if this is the difference between a person becoming, you know, extremely agitated and even violent and leaving AMA, why not let them have a cigarette? And I know hospitals do this. I've heard, a past guest on my show told me that when he was in residency in New York, that there was a smoking area in the hospital. And he's a young guy, so this is a not too distant past. And I think, well, you know, why not? Like, if we're talking about good patient outcomes here, maybe it does make sense to have some sort of allowance for cigarettes.
Yeah. And I think a lot of what we're discussing is harm reduction in whatever form it takes. It's trying to figure out how we can support a patient who's making decisions that we wouldn't necessarily make, but trying to help them do it in the safest way. And so no matter what the decision is, if we can help them, you know, help guide them to do it in a safer way and also take care of whatever health issues at the forefront, the reason that they're in the hospital, then that's, I think, our job as medical workers. Like, if you understand anything about addiction, people don't, no matter what the addiction is, people don't just stop doing a thing because they're asked to or whatever, right? There's like so much to it. And assuming that people are going to stop or change their behaviors, especially in an acute crisis when they're in a hospital setting, is kind of crazy, right? So, and I think often we ask people to do that. Like, you can't do this thing. And the person's like, but why? I do this thing every day. And so then you have to figure out how to negotiate to either allow that person to do that thing or find an alternative that's going to, you know, continue to support whatever health issue is there. And that all sounds very vague, but I think it's like a philosophical framework to take whenever something like this comes up.
Let's dive into this a little bit more. So a lot of patients experiencing homelessness have substance abuse issues, whether it be, you know, opioids. I think where I work, there's a lot of methamphetamine or alcohol. What are some strategies or frameworks that you have for helping these people in perhaps like an acute or critical situation to help them meet their healthcare needs while addressing their addictions?
Each substance use disorder is different and has its own challenges. I think, and depending on where you work in the country, you're facing different substances as the predominant ones that people use. But I think in general, when people are in the throes of addiction, that is often their priority. And it doesn't mean that they don't care about other things. I think that there's a lot of kind of incorrect understanding that, like, you know, a person doesn't care about their family because they're addicted to something. They're just biologically and
like neurochemically.
Yeah, neurochemically addicted to something. And that is very powerful. And so recognizing that, I think, is like step one.
I was just going to say one thing my mom, and one thing that she said to me, addiction is not a moral problem. And I think that has helped me kind of frame this in that these patients who are addicted to whatever substance, they're not immoral. It's something much deeper than it's a true disease that they have. And, you know, one that I've talked about in my past episode about alcohol, that there's a neurochemical imbalance such that they will do anything to get, you know, another drink or whatever opioid choice of their, you know, that they take. And I've seen patients literally die with alcohol bottles under their bed. So this is something hugely powerful and one that I found so helpful when my mom explained to me that, you know, it's not a moral issue.
Yeah. And I think that's so astute. Like, and it's like the perfect phrase to describe what's wrong with addiction care in America. It becomes a more, people see it as a moral problem, but it's a chronic disease, just like diabetes, just like congestive heart failure. And we don't apply the same moral feelings towards people who like don't take their insulin or eat poor, you know, and aren't managing their diabetes in the same way. And I often try to use that analogy when describing medication-assisted treatment for people who have substance use disorders, right? Like if your disease is addiction to opioids, and we can give you a medication that can help you not crave this drug, and it's safe and effective, then like, great. And there shouldn't be any sort of moral component to that. And I think when people come to the hospital and they do have some substance use disorder, they're a lot of times they're coming to the hospital like way later than they should, because, you know, for whatever reason, they've delayed coming. Often it's related to the substance. But also once they get there, you know, they don't want to feel bad. And no matter what the substance is, for the most part, whether it's, I mean, opioids in particular, people who use opioids, often their biggest fear is developing opioid withdrawal. And so that's, and this is not guessing that this is the case. My patients tell me this, like, I don't want to go to the hospital because they're not going to treat me with respect because I'm going to go into withdrawals and they won't give me anything. And so when I know someone is an opioid user, you know, we'll address the medical issue at hand, but then my next question is, when did you last use and how can I help you? And offer some kind of treatment. And if they're not interested, then we can take the next step of figuring out, you know, how to keep them comfortable. And I think there's also some often moral component to withholding opioids from people who maybe have legitimate pain in the acute setting, but feeling like, oh, we're just feeding their addiction. But I think we have to take a bigger picture look at what's going on with this person and sort of play the long game, right? Like, you know, if they're in pain and I'm not adequately treating their pain, they're probably going to leave, both because they're in pain and they might develop withdrawal. And so I think just putting things in perspective is important. And the same goes for every other substance. Like if people are chronically drinking and they're worried they're going to go into alcohol withdrawal and no one's taking that seriously in their mind, then they're probably going to leave because they don't want to feel awful. And same with methamphetamines. People get not withdrawal, but, you know, get really tired and cranky. And if they're not able to access their substance, then they might want to leave. So I think whatever their substance is, we have to figure out how can we respectfully keep that person comfortable and offer something. And often it's treatment. And, you know, unfortunately with methamphetamine, which is, yeah, by far the probably second where I work, but probably secondary to alcohol, there's just not a treatment for it. And so that is often frustrating because I can't do anything to keep that person in the hospital.
I was going
to
ask you maybe if we could kind of drill down, like seeing the alcohol, methamphetamines, and opioids are probably the three top substances of abuse that we see in the hospital. What are some like medical strategies you have for, you know, just addressing withdrawal from these three substances?
For opioids, I don't want to say it's the easiest because it's obviously a very challenging addiction, but there's good medications for it. And so from a provider standpoint, I think that there are like options, good options to offer people. And it's becoming increasingly common for hospitals to have access to buprenorphine, which is the generic term, generic name for the drug Suboxone, which is one of the most effective drugs that exists for any disease process now. And that sounds crazy, but when you look at the numbers needed to treat, meaning like how many people benefit from a drug who received it, it's 2 to 3 with buprenorphine, which, you know, the effect of that is preventing death and keeping people on treatment, as opposed to something like aspirin after a person has a heart attack, which is like in the 50s, I think. So this is incredibly effective, but not a lot of hospitals in the past had had it. And in the Bay Area, it's becoming much more common. So that is my go-to for anyone, because its effect comes on quick for anyone who's in withdrawal, and it's safe. You can give people tons of it and they wouldn't overdose because it has a ceiling effect. So you could keep taking it and it wouldn't cause you respiratory depression. But not all hospitals have a policy for it. And I think if yours doesn't, it's good to start asking questions about how you can implement this, because it's becoming the mainstay of treatment for people.
I love it. I love it. Okay. Opioids. I'm glad you went over that, because honestly, I have very little experience with opioids. But moving on to, you know, the bread and butter, what I see. What about alcohol and methamphetamine abuse?
Yeah. So for alcohol, I mean, to treat withdrawal is, you know, the mainstay of that are benzodiazepines or phenobarbital. And I think when people aren't exhibiting signs of withdrawal, they sometimes will ask for something and the response is, well, you don't look like you need it. But people start to feel unwell pretty soon after they've had their last drink if they're a chronic drinker. So there are other medications you can use to help people feel better, and also will like treat some components of the alcohol withdrawal. Gabapentin's been really effective and it's safe if there's some, you know, concern about giving a person benzodiazepines or phenobarbital. Clonidine can help in the same way that it does with opioids to sort of calm your autonomic system. Mm-hmm. But then people who drink regularly, who are sitting there talking to you, like giving them a few milligrams of Ativan is not, or Valium is not going to put them to sleep. So if someone's asking and they're going to be admitted to the hospital, then I try to start giving them something early so that we don't get into a mess and the person feeling awful, or they leave because they're not preemptively being treated with anything.
Okay. I've actually done a whole podcast episode about alcohol withdrawal, because it's very confusing. You know, there's so many different protocols out there, you know, benzodiazepines, phenobar, which, you know, seems like the big hot drug right now. One I've never seen ordered. And then, yeah, gabapentin. And I know before you were saying methamphetamine can be the most challenging. What can we do for our patients coming off of methamphetamines?
This is like the million-dollar question. And okay, we talk about this all the time when I was working in healthcare for the homeless and in addiction conferences I go to. There's not a good treatment for methamphetamine. And the problem is people are either, you know, coming in after recently using and they're pretty agitated or like, you know, coming down from that, or they're super sleepy. And there's people who,
because they haven't slept in like 3 days.
Yeah. And just like with any amphetamine, when you use it, you crash afterwards. So people get super sleepy. You know, the main thing that I offer people who like are feeling agitated or something to calm them down. So it could be benzodiazepines, although it's probably better to avoid those in people who don't have, you know, a problem with alcohol. But things like mirtazapine or different antipsychotics can help if people are like feeling really antsy to help calm them down. And in particular, risperidone has some data, I think, for people, or at least anecdotally, my patients have said, like, sometimes that drug just makes me feel a lot better. There's like long-term drugs to help curb methamphetamine use. Naltrexone is one, which is also used for alcohol, but that's not going to be helpful in the acute setting. That's more of a long-term thing. So I think we have a really unique thing at the hospital I left, but there's funding is becoming more abundant for this. We had a substance use navigator in our emergency department in hospital. Nice. And so when people presented with substance use disorders, we could call this person to come, and they were often, even if they couldn't, offer a treatment for the situation. They could often just be someone who was well-informed about addiction to like be a calming voice to the individual. And so, you know, if there's some version of that at your hospital, it has been really helpful to just have a person to come support that individual.
Would this person be an advanced practitioner, or, you know, would they be a nurse? Would they be a social worker? Like, what was their background?
Yes. So we hired them under what's called a community health worker in my system. I think there's different versions of what that person is across California. There's something called the ED Bridge program, which has been funding this, these positions, but they're usually not clinical in the sense that they're a nurse or a PA or NP or anything. They're like social worker, community health worker level. So someone who's knowledgeable about kind of more of the resources that are available for addiction services, or just aware of what people are going through to kind of be a support person. It's kind of modeled behind like a patient navigator for oncology. It's like really challenging, you know, set of services to get through, and people are often in crisis and having a hard time listening and need a person to navigate them through the system. It's the same kind of idea, but with substance use disorders.
Okay. So to wrap up this substance abuse topic, I kind of want to walk through, like, let's say, you know, I'm a nurse and maybe I'm working in an emergency or in an inpatient setting. I have a patient who's, you know, maybe homeless or not, I guess it doesn't matter, right? They're experiencing withdrawal or anxiety about perhaps going through withdrawal soon from a substance. What are some questions that I could ask the patient and then present to the physician on a phone call? For example, an alcoholic patient who's being admitted who needs to stay in the hospital, maybe because of some sort of fracture. And they're threatening to leave AMA because they really want to have a drink. So kind of maybe walk through some questions that the nurse could ask the patient in order to communicate effectively with their doctor to address the situation and hopefully meet the patient's needs and keep them in the hospital.
When you're doing, if this person's being admitted to the hospital, there's, I know in most places, like an intake questionnaire, and that involves a history of substance use. So, and if the patient's already bringing up that they want, you know, have been drinking and want to leave, I think it's good to ask them, like, okay, I want to help keep you in the hospital. Like, how do you think we can do that? And I often flip the situation so that the patient can tell me what they need within the context of the hospital, right? So if they need a drink, well, you can't have a drink. We don't have that. But if I tell them, we don't have a drink, I'm telling them no to something. So instead I'm asking, how can I help you thrive or at least stabilize in this environment? And so then they might say, I need some Ativan or whatever. So that's one way, I think, but also just getting a sense of, okay, it sounds like you're starting to feel unwell. How much do you drink each day? And have you ever had, you know, withdrawal symptoms before? Where does that fall in the scheme of like, or, you know, the way you're feeling now, how does that fall in the scheme of your alcohol withdrawal? Like, have you had seizures before? Does this feel like it's close to that point? Just getting a sense of where the patient's at and how bad they're feeling and when their last drink was. Because if their last drink was 24 hours ago, I'm pretty worried this person actually might go in alcohol withdrawal, right?
Yeah.
If it's 2 hours ago,
you got
probably
some
not going to go in, foam in an alcohol withdrawal, but they're probably going to start feeling bad. And there are those people who are really heavy drinkers who 2 or 3 hours, they actually do start to exhibiting some symptoms. So getting a sense of that and then asking the patient what they want. And if it's unreasonable, then you negotiate. And if it's not, you know, what makes you feel good? You know, 7 of Ativan? No, you can't have that. But let me see what I can get.
Maybe then, we can spread that over like a bunch of hours. But
Exactly. And then I think you can get a sense, and then you can present that to the clinician, right? Like, okay, you know, this patient is admitted for this. They express that they have a pretty significant history of alcohol use. Their last drink was this time, you know, however long ago, and they're starting to feel unwell. I'm worried they're going to leave. Because I also think there's so much to the way you phrase things. And, yes. And I hate to digress about this, but I really don't like the term a patient refused. Because it, when I first heard it in medicine, I was like, this is such a harsh word. So I often say like people decline, but also I think if you say the patient's threatening to leave, it like primes people to feel like there's some tension there. Right. So I think if you present it in a way that's like, you know, what, like I just said, but also, I'm worried that the patient might leave, because they're starting to feel unwell. What do you think about giving them something to help prevent alcohol withdrawal? And then whatever that thing might be, I think is a helpful way, because no one wants the patient to leave. And if they're threatening, I think it primes people to be like, well, fine, let them leave. But really what you're advocating for is to help them stay comfortable and support them through their hospital journey.
This is so great. I guess we're really whittling down to how nurses can become most effective. And, you know, the overall aim is not only to improve nursing practice, but to build bridges between the nurses and, you know, other healthcare staff. And if a nurse can ask those kind of, you know, open-ended questions like, when was your last drink, you know, when was the last time you took this drug? What has worked for you in the past? That's one I often ask my patients. Or what can we do to make you most comfortable? And then present it to the doctor. Not only is a nurse then providing good care to the patient, but they're also being very effective within the healthcare team.
Yeah, and I think on any issue, the nurse spends so much more time with the patient than the doctor, right? And so their relationship is more intimate. They learn more about the patient, and they can be such a better advocate because they have some deeper understanding of what the patient's going through. And so, you know, I the best examples of troubleshooting these types of situations in the hospital have always been a nurse who's a strong patient advocate, who's really well-informed, who cares a lot about the patient, working well with other team members to try to figure out how to do this together. And I think, like, you know, if a nurse is telling me a patient's not feeling well, if the two of us go over to the bedside together and chat with the patient, that's much more powerful than if it's a game, you know, if it's possible, that's much more powerful than a game of telephone where someone comes in and says, I heard you need this or whatever.
Oh,
that way,
totally.
Everyone's hearing the same thing, right?
Yeah. That's a strategy that we use in our hospital for, and I hate to say difficult patient, but, you know, if there's, you know, tension, you know, rising, that we approach the patient as a team together, right? So everyone gets on the same page together. And I guess it also shows that we care too, that we're bringing multiple people to their bedside to address their, whatever it is that needs to be addressed with them.
Yeah. And then sometimes I feel like the patients can't always articulate what they need in the way that you interpreted it and maybe said it back to them. And so I think it's often really helpful if a nurse asks me to go talk to a patient and they come with me and the patient says something that's not quite what they want, then the nurse can say, remember before when you said this thing? And the patient can be like, oh yeah, that's actually what I need. You know, that's like so helpful. I can't count the number of times that I've gone to see a patient, talked about whatever their problem was, then gone back in with a nurse. And I try to ask pretty frequently if someone's homeless or look in their chart or whatever, but where I just didn't notice it. And then I'm, you know, setting up some situation and the nurse is like, you know, they said they're homeless. And then I'm like, oh, wow, that changes a lot about what I'm going to do, you know?
Yeah.
So there's so much information that can be gleaned for sure.
Yeah. Okay. So moving on to, you know, well, the last topic we'll go over here is, you know, maybe something a little more lighthearted, which is food. And this is one of the things that I first noticed when caring for homeless patients in the hospital is that they often are very preoccupied with food. One trick that I've established with my patients is, you know, if I sense that they are very concerned about food, I'll make sure that they get, you know, extra portions if, you know, it's allowed for them. Or, you know, I'll frequently check in with them. Are you hungry? And just kind of keep the food supply running. But I was wondering if you could just talk about their need for food or their prioritization of food that's different than, you know, our other patients and how we can help address these needs.
When you're considering this situation, I think it's important to put it in the context of how easy it is for someone with resources and a home to access food, and then compare it to a person who doesn't have a home and probably, you know, doesn't get more than, if they're lucky, $900 a month in like SSI, but most of the time, a lot of folks are living on like general assistance, which is $200, $300 a week. And a small portion of our patients, unfortunately, a smaller portion than should have food stamps. So people have a really challenging time getting access to food when they want it. Now, there's a lot of resources for people to get food in the communities, at least in the Bay Area, but just opening a refrigerator and getting access to some to what they want to eat is not a convenience that most people have. So when people come to the hospital and they know that there's food there, you're right, like more commonly than I expected, I like talk to a patient about a pretty significant illness and I ask if they have questions and they ask me if they can have food. And I'm like, did you just hear that I said, you know, you have like a new diagnosis of heart failure? That's okay, right? Like they're going to stay in the hospital and they're hungry and they're worried about their, you know, a different part of their hierarchy of needs than I am.
Yes. And that's such a great way of putting it.
Yeah. And I think often, you know, we're all busy and a patient's constantly asking us for extra, this is in the emergency department, but I know on the floors it happens in the same way, I'm sure. Constantly asking us for extra juice or more food. It can be challenging. And our emergency department is often, you know, busy and nurses are running to different rooms. And so I often just get patients food because it's easy for me and I know where it is. And I don't, if sometimes people are yelling in the hallway and I want them to stop that.
Yeah.
I just ask them what they want. And I think it's an easy thing to do, you know, similar to like I was saying before, like, okay, what do you need? How can I get, you want 3 turkey sandwiches? Fine. I don't care. This is probably $10 for the hospital. And it's like a fraction of all the other things that are happening here that we're being wasteful about and charging, right?
Yes.
But
yes.
For some reason, there's some often like antagonism related to people repeatedly asking for food. Like, you don't need this extra food. I think really, again, we should put it in perspective and like consider why we're fighting with patients about this. I think it happens to me too. Like I get triggered. Why do you need a seventh juice or whatever, but who cares, right? And it reminds me, our organization that I was, Healthcare for the Homeless that I was working for before started doing needle exchange. And the person who kind of educated me about it was talking about how when she first started doing it, these people would come and ask for like 200, 300 needles at a time. And she would feel this resistance to giving it to them. And then at some point was like, why do I care? This person's asking for it. They need it. So, and I have it, so I can give it to them. And I think it's a weird analogy because there's needles and food, but they're for people who are asking for excess of things, even if they're stuffing their pockets with them and they're walking out of the hospital, like, I don't care if they have some extra graham crackers. And I don't know that I need to ask why, because if they're requesting it, then they're probably hungry. And I think that there's often a habit of hoarding among folks living on the street because they don't know when they might be able to get access to that thing again. And that I think is it's noticeable in encampments where there's piles of clothes and, you know, all this junk that people collect that we see all over the Bay Area alongside the highway or wherever. But I think it's an adaptive behavior that people develop after a lifetime or however long of not having access to things, that they start collecting it to make sure that they have it in case they need it. And the same goes with food. People start, you know, collecting it. And I think among the things that we're going to argue with patients about in the hospital, it's a pretty easy one. You know, unless it's like they want, you know, the equivalent of 6,000 milligrams of salt in their CHF patient or something. But again, then you compromise. So I think the food thing is, you know, it can be frustrating, but I often just put it in perspective and give patients what they ask for.
Yeah, and I found that it's best to deal with this upfront in your interactions with the patient to kind of save you from, you know, later down the line that, you know, once, you know, their insecurities with food are addressed, that I think the rest of your interactions are going to go smoother.
Yeah, and I often use it even preemptively as a way to build rapport with patients.
Really?
Like, even if they don't ask for food, you know, more so in situations where there's maybe a little bit of antagonism off the bat or the patient's frustrated. I find it's a nice way to humanize the situation with people. Like, hey, can I get you some food or something? Because it's a non-medical intervention that people often want. And it helps start a conversation where I'm not arguing about a medical need or discussing something that the patient doesn't want to deal with at the time. And then they're eating their sandwich. I can bring it up because they are doing something and, you know, feel like I've offered them something that, that they actually might want.
Yeah. And I guess on the side is food can be therapeutic for everyone, not just those who have food insecurities.
Totally. Right.
Yeah. Okay. Is there anything else that you would like to cover?
The most amazing thing that I've started doing during my time with Healthcare for the Homeless that's like blown my mind is just asking patients to see their medications if they have them. And people have had like full size shopping bags full of pills that they have no idea what any of them are. But their hospital MAR or, you know, their EHR MAR like doesn't demonstrate this. And I know this is like the hugest pain in the butt for a nurse to go through every single medication. But even in outpatient, when I'm doing like care in the shelters or now people are living in motels, I often spend the most time going through people's medications because it's super confusing. And especially people who are transient, they end up going to multiple hospitals, getting multiple prescriptions, often redundant prescriptions, different doses, medications that aren't compatible with each other. So of the things that we can do with the med rec for folks who are living on the street can often be super informative and maybe even, you know, uncover some problem that they're having related to their medications. You know, the person was found down. Oh, look, they're taking three beta blockers that are the same effectively or whatever. There's all sorts of crazy examples that I've found with patients like that. And like there was this one patient who actually my wife called me about one time because he was my patient, but happened to be in Oakland and wanted to get some help reconnecting him. And this guy goes all over the Bay, like Marin, Contra Costa, Alameda, and just has this tote bag full of medications. And he fills them. Like he actually goes to the pharmacy and fills them, but I don't know which ones he's taking. So I just go through and throw the ones away that he's not taking. And he may continue to do that, but at least he's not, at least I'm aware what medications he's taking. So I think that can be a time consuming thing to do as a nurse, but it can be super helpful to figure out like what someone's actually taking and what they have on them.
Okay. And just a heads up for nurses listening to this who don't work in emergency. I know at my hospital, we have a pharmacy tech, but we have a designated person who does medication reconciliation and they can help you, you know, really thoroughly go through your patient's medications that they have physically there and in their medical record too.
Yeah, that sounds nice. I don't know that we have that.
Is there anything else that you would like to bring up? Everything you're saying is just, is really great and informing. So please, like, if there's anything else, go ahead.
I think it's just helpful because there's all sorts of behaviors that people exhibit in the hospital, and particularly when they're homeless. They may often feel stigmatized and you might not even realize it. And I think this idea of having trauma-informed approach to patients is really important because often our mind reflexively goes to what's wrong with you, why are you behaving this way? And I think it's helpful to reframe that to what happened to you and reconsider like why a patient might be behaving in a certain way and maybe just trying, I don't know that you necessarily have to ask them about it, but maybe just trying to understand where they're coming from. You know, like often people get really angry and frustrated. And when I start to learn more about why they were behaving that way, it's like, oh, you, whatever, had this horrible situation in a hospital, or you were assaulted, or you have a history of sexual trauma, whatever the thing may be. I think just leaving space to try to understand why they're acting that way and like what the history that led to it would be so that you can maybe be more empathetic to that situation is helpful. And I think especially, you know, like I said, with nurses who are spending so much more time with patients, they I think get a bigger slice of where people are coming from and have the potential to understand them better.
Yeah. I really liked how you put that. And I'm going to put that in the show notes, you know, kind of highlight like changing your mindset from what's wrong with the patient to what happened to the patient. Because no one wants to be homeless, right? Like no one chooses that lifestyle that they have.
No, and I think that that is actually a really important point that I didn't bring up. And the one other thing I was going to say is if folks have any opportunity to see where people who are experiencing homelessness are sheltered or get services, I think it's really enlightening. Like in particular, I mentioned before, we have a respite shelter in our county, and we're constantly getting referred folks who are pretty sick, who need mostly SNF level care, and having to say no because we don't have the resources to safely house them there. And until we've had some folks from our hospital come visit, we continue to like get these referrals and people get frustrated. But once you come and see the setting that people live in, I think it's hard to understand where they're being discharged to and what resources are available. And also often patients are complaining about, oh, this place is horrible. They kick us out during the day or whatever the situation is. But if you can just pop in and learn more about it, it can be really helpful to both guide patients so they understand where they're going and also understand yourself what it's like, so that you're not, telling the patient something other than what the environment is like. And I mean, maybe just meeting with social workers and getting their take on things can be enough. And we didn't have social workers 24/7 at my hospital. So like at night, if you didn't know about the services or you didn't know the way to refer people or get them what they need, just didn't happen often. And so it was pretty enlightening going through the process of taking this position and learning about all the resources and then asking people at night about them or at times when there weren't social workers, how many folks really knew nothing. And, they're focused on the medical stuff, but I think in situations where people don't have a home, and that's often one of the contributing factors to their disease, it is part of the medical care. And so it's helpful to learn the resources as best you can, because I think it often leads to better care and better outcomes for people.
Right. Totally. I think if you're truly focused on better outcomes, then you kind of have to step out of your medical role often and learn about, these resources that are available.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Dr. Mega. I really appreciate everything that you've said, and I feel like I'm much better equipped to deal with patients experiencing homelessness in the future. So thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. I think that was a pretty enlightening interview. Dr. Mega brought up some points that I think will help me improve my practice, and not only with my patients experiencing homelessness, but with all of my patients. I think I get narrow vision sometimes as a nurse because I only see my patients in a hospital setting, and I'm just so damn focused on their medical stability. But now, after getting some perspective from Dr. Mega, I'm going to try to take the time and assume some responsibility for addressing the needs of my homeless patients, such as food, their belongings, a possible pet or substance abuse problem. By addressing some of these non-medical needs, I can hopefully influence better health outcomes as well. Before we go, I wanted to share a little news. I recently accepted a new position at a hospital in their float pool. This is 90% exciting and 10% nerve-wracking because I need to be responsible for quite a breadth of knowledge as I will float to 33 different floors. Yes, 33 floors. So to prepare, I got myself a set of Tribe RN's badge cards. You know, those little cards of information that you attach to your badge reel and reference by grabbing your badge and turning it over. So I decided that I'm going to keep the set of cards in my locker and choose the cards for my reel based on the floor I'll be working on that day. You know, so for example, if I go to a neuro floor, I'll grab the NIH scale cards. If I float to telemetry, I'll grab the ECG cards. If I float to pulmonary floor, I'll grab the cards
that go over breath sounds. I decided I'm going to start with a normal adult lab values cards. You know, the little fishbone diagrams. For some reason, this shorthand has just never stuck with me, but I think it would be so helpful for taking thorough notes quickly. I'm so happy with these badge cards that I wanted to tell you guys about them. They're made by a wonderful nurse named Chelsea, who has dedicated her career to helping fellow nurses by creating resource tools, like these badge cards, but also pen lights and cheat sheets. She also has a super active Facebook group that would be great for those of you who are social media happy, and it serves to empower nurses through community. If you would like to buy a set of her badge cards, which I especially recommend for new nurses, head over to tribe-rn.com. But I am also giving a set away. And if you'd like to win a set of these badge cards, go to upmynursinggame.com and enter your email address to get notified when episodes are released. Look, I get that not everyone is an avid podcast listener who subscribes to podcasts and keeps up to date on them. So, I've started an email list so that listeners can get a friendly little announcement in their inboxes when new episodes are released. So again, go to upmynursinggame.com to sign up to receive email notifications for a chance to win a set of Tribe RN's complete Badge Guru set by Monday, April 5th. All right, that's all for today. Thanks for listening. I hope that you have upped your nursing game.